are your Will.
Yep. And you are Katie.
Yep. Still. Forever.
Channeling Elliot Kalin. I like it.
I do love them. Elliot, Stuart, Dan, if you're listening, I love you. So this is our episode 3.
Yeah, we're back.
Pretty exciting.
Halfway through season 1.
Halfway through season 1. This is where it starts to go horribly wrong. We're talking about something today that is pretty controversial and lots of people talk about it. So we're kind of nervous and excited to discuss it, I guess. Do you want to tell everyone what we're talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about Jaime Lannister.
Jaime Lannister, who's portrayed by one of the world's most handsome men.
Nicolaj Coster-Waldau?
That sounds about right.
That sounds terribly wrong.
It's Nikolai something, yeah. He's great. We like him a lot. But yeah, it's
so this is
going to be a good one, I think.
This is a little different from the last two episodes because it's going to be more of a deep dive into this specific character rather than kind of talking about something in general.
Absolutely. And also, we're on opposite sides of the fence for this one, I think.
Yeah. Yep. There's a little bit of disagreement about Jaime here, which is the whole point of this episode. But before we actually start talking about him, we should give a spoiler warning that if you haven't read Game of Thrones, the book series, A Song of Ice and Fire, or watched the TV show, then you might not want to listen to this because we're going to reveal things that happened to this character in those books. If you've only watched the TV show or only read the books, you should be fine. Because this, even though the plots diverge, like, you know enough of the major stuff anyway.
And to be honest, if you haven't listened to them, watched the show or read the books, then this won't be interesting anyway.
It might be, but we're going to assume a base level of knowledge just because we can't retell the whole story. We tried doing that once in one of our conversations, and it was really easy to get in the weeds kind of explaining who every character was and their relationship. So this kind of assumes a base level of knowledge. And if you haven't finished the books or you're reading them or you haven't finished a TV show, you know, none of the spoilers are like super major for the show spoilers. They're mostly just spoilers for this character.
Character spoilers rather than narrative spoilers.
Right. And there's also some stuff that is pretty gruesome in Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, like terrible things happening to people, rape, murder, torture, child abuse. So if you don't want to hear any of that discussed or you're sensitive to that kind of thing, then you might not want to listen to this episode for that reason too.
Yeah, not that we're going to go into detail, but obviously you have to discuss these themes when discussing this wider show. I think we both are agreed that Game of Thrones, the TV show, is super problematic, and there are also, the books are also quite problematic. So we recognize that, and in no way is this a defense of either.
Yes, I don't even want to get into
that.
We should have another episode about what's wrong with the TV show versus the books.
Almost everything. There you go. No need for an episode.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you pretty much covered it.
Yep. Succinct, to the point.
Okay. So this episode is going to be about Jaime, and it's specifically about me wanting to defend Jaime Lannister. And I think there's kind of two major misconceptions, what I consider misconceptions. There's, I think, groups of fans and TV watchers and book readers who don't like Jaime and think that he is a bad guy or he's amoral and selfish and evil, and they don't like him for that reason. And then there's another group, usually the book readers, I think that Jaime started out being amoral and dishonorable and selfish and evil, but throughout the events of the book, like the quote-unquote present-day events that happen in the book, he kind of turns it around and becomes a good person. And I also disagree with that reading of it, so I kind of want to take a contra stance on both of those.
Absolutely. And this conversation kind of spun out of a wider discussion about heroism in Game of Thrones, and so we're kind of looking at Jaime as not just a good character, but also as a heroic character in both the stereotype of what a hero is supposed to be, the genre, and within the genre, and also within kind of our own modern world or whatever.
Right. So the point that I'm kind of defending here is that Jaime is a heroic character. He's probably a tragic hero, but that he is heroic and that he is good and heroic in many ways before his quote-unquote redemptive arc. And although events in the book and TV show lead him to kind of change his personality a little bit and lead him to life changes, he's not going from this kind of terrible evil character and doing an about face and becoming a good character, that he was always kind of good. And a lot of the redemption is about kind of reasserting his identity and getting rid of bad relationships in his life.
Godspeed, because that is a very difficult defense to mount.
Yeah. All right. So
let's go through all the terrible things that Jamie has done.
Right. So I think we should first give kind of like what I think the general view of Jamie is, that he is, he's the male version of Cersei, that he's arrogant. He's amoral. He's selfish, and he does terrible things to people in kind of a cavalier, dismissive way, in the same way Cersei does. And he can be cruel and vicious in the same way Cersei is. And that they're basically two sides of a very similar coin. The same coin. Yeah. Two sides of a shitty coin.
Yeah.
And this picture of Jaime comes mostly from the first two books, where we learn four major things about Cersei, or about Jaime. Yep. And about his life. So I want to just go through those four things. And I want to go through them basically from the point of view of the reader as recounted by other characters. So not as recounted by Jaime himself. But we'll get to that later. So the first thing that we see basically with Jaime is Bran. Pushing Bran out the window. Bran is climbing the buildings around Winterfell, and he finds Jaime and Cersei sleeping together, and Jaime kind of grabs him and picks him up and stands him in the window, says, "The things I do for love," and he shoves him out with the intent to kill him.
Attempted infanticide.
Yeah, attempted child murder is basically our first impression of Jaime Lannister. So
a strong first impression.
It doesn't get off on a good foot.
Doesn't get much worse than that. There's much worse in like terms of immoral crimes that you can commit than trying to kill a kid. So good luck. I say again.
Sounds like
I'm laughing at child murder.
In that moment, I also don't want anyone to think that I'm going to defend child murder, but
we'll get to it. So yeah, infanticide or attempted. Yeah.
And the other thing that we learn in that moment is, of course, that he has a sexual relationship with his sister, that he's committing incest, which is also kind of like betraying the trust of the king because she's the queen. And cuckolding the king. And you find out throughout the first book that the king's children are actually the children of Jaime and Cersei. So he's kind of, you know, his bastards are kind of falsely heirs to the throne, and this is in line with kind of the whole thing with his family, which seems to be that they're all very amoral and they all want power and they don't really care about their actions except for how they affect themselves. And the whole Lannisters, I think, are painted in the first few books as, you know, being on the verge of taking over Westeros, that like you're going to have these full-blood Lannister children sitting on the throne, and you're going to have Tywin, his father, being the Warden of the West.
And bankrolling everything.
And Cersei being queen, and Robert might appoint Jaime to be Warden of the East, and you're going to have like this Lannister takeover, either through direct kind of power plays or through indirect lineage secession, passing on to Lannister children instead of the legitimate children of Robert Baratheon.
They're the baddies, right? For all intents and purposes, at least in the first couple of books, Lannisters are the baddies, the Starks are the goodies, and that's kind of the end of it.
And I think this has made Cersei's a horrible person, and him having a relationship with Cersei is made worse because of how bad she is. And I think it's also made worse because of Joffrey and the fact that the most notable of their children is just this horrible, horrible monster.
Yeah. So that's two.
So the third thing is what happens with Tyrion and Tysha. So Tyrion is Jaime's brother, And this is not as well known as the other things in the books, but it's really important to Tyrion. And you get this story when you read Tyrion's point of view chapters, that when they were young, Tyrion and Jaime rescued this young girl named Tysha, who was being attacked by bandits, and Jaime chased them off, and Tyrion ends up falling in love with this girl, and they get secretly married, and they live together playing house for like 2 weeks, until their father, Tywin Lannister, who is also cruel and vicious, finds out that Tyrion has secretly married this woman, and kind of publicly shames him, and does, you know, horrific, brutal punishment of Tysha by having his entire guard rape her, and forces Tyrion to take part in it, and reveals to Tyrion that this whole thing was a setup, that Jaime arranged the entire thing, that this woman didn't really love him, that there was not it wasn't a real rescue, and that their marriage was fake, and that all she was doing was trying to enrich herself by making herself close to the Lannisters, and that she had no real love or affection for Tyrion, which completely destroys Tyrion and warps his entire ability to have relationships and destroys his self-worth even more. And it's kind of weird, because when you get this story in Tyrion's head, he actually likes Jaime for arranging the whole thing, and he sees that as being like an act of kindness, that his brother kind of set up this scenario so that he would have a chance to, you know, sleep with a woman and feel heroic. And he doesn't blame Jaime for what his father did. But I think as the audience and as the readers, we're supposed to see that as kind of pathetic, that he would like Jaime for that. And we see it as kind of cruel that Jaime would participate in arranging this thing, even if he didn't know that Tyrion was going to be punished horribly and that Tysha was going to be punished horribly by Tywin.
All right. It's a brutal memory, actually. Yes,
it's horrible. And it drives a lot of the plot for Tyrion. A lot of his motivations and his personality is based on that kind of formative moment. And the fourth thing is the thing that is the most well-known probably to book readers and like in-universe in Westeros, what everybody knows Jaime for, is that he was appointed to be a member of the Kingsguard, which is like the, you know, Secret Service crack team of the best knights who guard the king, and he's the youngest ever Kingsguard member. And during Robert's Rebellion, when Robert and Ned Stark and everyone are trying to overthrow Aerys, the former king before the books and the show starts, that at the climax of that, when they're storming King's Landing, the capital city, particularly Tywin's army is at the gates of King's Landing, that Jaime kills the king he was supposed to protect. So he cuts Aerys' throat, and then his father enters the city, and they sack the city, and Ned Stark finds Jaime sitting on the throne with a bloody sword, kind of making jokes about what has happened, and making jokes about, you know, who's going to be the king. And so everyone in Westeros calls him the Kingslayer for this, and everyone thinks he has complete shit for honor. And it appears to everybody that he, you know, he basically did this, like everything the Lannisters do, to help their own family and to help enrich their own family. And it's made even worse because Tywin's army, just they destroy the royal family, horrible, horrible things they do to the royal family that's still alive, and they sack the city and they almost destroy King's Landing. And so it looks like, you know, Jaime was basically just helping out his dad take over and destroy King's Landing and forsaking any kind of vows or honor that he might have had about protecting the king. So you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. I mean, there's probably some bits, like people will probably think that we've missed out some things, but these are kind of formative things that he's done that most of the fan base would be familiar with, right? And it's like these four things kind of define a lot of his character and his presentation, I guess, in the first couple of books, because we don't have a Jaime chapter, so we don't really see it from his perspective, but that's definitely how he's perceived, you know? So they're quite big crimes as well to commit during that period, and of course today most of them. So I think that is a very good summary and succinctly put.
Right.
So good luck. Again, I keep saying it because like it's a hard task, I think, to defend a character that does you know, pretty, even by today's standards, pretty immoral things.
Well, I think, but I think most of book readers understand that there's an other side to those four events that makes them a little bit more sympathetic. I don't know if they would make Jamie heroic, but I think that, you know.
So, but your defense of Jamie isn't that he's a hero, right? It's because, and by hero, the classic hero is like Tolkien, and it's like completely without flaw and always does the right thing and will always prosper because they're brilliant. And one of the things that Game of Thrones does well is that it's a much more realistic representation of reality. It kind of puts the realness into the fantasy realm, where actually just because you're a good person doesn't mean you're going to prosper and win. I think if we compare it to Lord of the Rings, which is one of the other big fantasy franchises, no one ever doubted that Frodo was going to get that ring in the fire and everything was going to be fine. You know, it's like really obvious right from the beginning that everything's going to be okay. You might have one or two casualties, but it's not going to be, it's not going to end with the, you know, immoral dark people prospering, but it's right. You know, the good will triumph because good always triumphs, to quote Buffy. But the just slips into my like everyday colloquialisms, but that's not the case in Game of Thrones. So right. You can have a hero that's morally flawed.
Yeah, and I wouldn't argue that he's like a romantic hero in the kind of Tolkien sense at all.
No,
he's kind of a pragmatic hero and a tragic hero, if he's a hero at all.
There's not even a romantic hero in all of Game of Thrones.
Or if like, there is, they get killed as, you know, as soon as possible.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the way to look at it is that he's not someone like Sir Gregor Clegane, who's just, you know, an absolute monster.
He is.
And I think that maybe people might compare Jaime's motivation to someone like Littlefinger.
Yeah.
Which seems to be extremely pragmatic, with the goal of kind of self-aggrandizement and self-enriching.
The self-made man.
Right, and he wants power, and he's power-hungry, and he does these things that will benefit him. And he cares about people in some ways, but he's mostly out to benefit himself and doesn't really care what happens to anybody else. And I think that Jaime is not even like that. I think that Jaime is motivated by desires to be a good person and do the right thing, quote unquote, do the right thing, whatever he thinks that is, rather than being kind of an amoral, selfish bastard, but that he's presented that way.
Okay. So do you want to try and suggest that, and then we'll see what you come up with?
Right. So I think we should go through the other side of those four things.
The other side of those four things.
So the easiest one is probably the Tyrion Tysha thing.
Yeah.
So once you get farther in the books and you start getting in Jamie's point of view, at some point it comes out that Jamie wasn't actually in on that, that he didn't actually arrange the entire thing, that Tysha really was just this random girl who was being attacked by bandits, and they really did rescue her. And as far as he knows, she really did love Tyrion and wanted to be with him and was completely genuine. And he went along with the lie that Tywin created, because Tywin basically forced him to and told him, this girl is taking advantage of your brother. She needs to learn. This lesson will be good for him. This is what will make him a man. He needs to stop. You know, he needs to grow up. And it's kind of Tywin's orchestrating. It's kind of Tywin's orchestration of this whole thing that makes it happen, and that Jaime in many ways is just as much of a pawn of it as Tyrion was.
I think that brings up one problem with Jaime, in that he's kind of super controlled by Tywin for, like, it looks like most of his youth and early life. He just sort of did what his dad said. And so, you know, if you're just going to follow blindly what your parents do, then if your parents are bad, then you're going to be a baddie. And that's like the way it goes, right? He doesn't kind of necessarily question it. And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a combination of Cersei and Tywin. There's two kind of primary relationships, and I think that they continually use him, basically, and he goes along with it. I don't know. Tywin's intimidating, right? He might not know better. Tywin is his
that
father,
fantastic first scene where Charles Dance portrays Tywin, where he's skinning a stag. It's perfect. It's such an amazing amazingly shot scene, and Charles Dance's performance is so intimidating, but his like methodical approach to skinning that animal perfectly sets up his character, who is, you know, just driven and methodical in his approach to everything. He completely dismisses his children's feelings about anything. They're just pawns to him, and he's using them to
everything is about like family legacy.
Everything's about his legacy, and everything's about what he can achieve if he just applies pressure in the right way. And he's such a character with completely bankrupt of any kind of emotion, warmth, morality, anything like that. So one of the things that we need to look at when we look at Jamie is how that influenced his early decisions in life, I think.
And a lot of Tywin is motivated by his father, Tytos, who was kind of a laughingstock, and Tywin was always ashamed of him and saw him as being weak. And so he kind of created this counter persona of like, no one will ever laugh at Tywin Lannister, right?
Yeah.
Everyone will fear me and respect me, and I will never be seen as like being a fool or being taken advantage of or being duped.
Yeah. Which is why he hates Tyrion so much, I think, because Tyrion constantly makes his dad look like an idiot. And, because he's smart and he's clever and his dad can't cope with it.
Yeah, I mean, his whole existence is kind of supposed to be an embarrassment to the Lannisters. Yeah, the fact that he's a dwarf and he's disformed and...
Yeah.
All right, that's the Tywin, Tyrion, Tysha thing. All these TY names.
TY.
And, all right, so number two, I think we should talk about pushing Bran out the window.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's no real way of, like, defending this specific act as being something that's good. I want to make it clear that, like, this is not
support child.
Right. This is not Draco.
Thanks for clarifying that.
This is not a Draco in leather pants situation either, where the trope where you spin kind of a bad character into being good and you justify all of their decisions and you refuse to accept any criticism or flaws that character might have.
This
Jamie is a great character and he does bad things, but I think the motivation for this is the thing that is important. So the act may be a bad act, but the motivation, when you see it happening, it comes off as kind of a callous, cavalier thing, right?
Because it's the quip. I think it's the quip that makes it seem cavalier.
The things I do for love, he says, right? Yeah, he looks at Cersei and he shoves Bran out the window. And he does it so quickly and without any kind of deliberation or hemming and hawing about, you know, basically the decision to murder a child. He just does it. And he doesn't seem, you know, racked with any kind of guilt about it or afterward. It looks like it's meaningless to him. So part of that is because we're not in Jamie's head and we don't know what Jamie's like. But I think his real motivation is that he's put in this position where if people find out about him and Cersei, they'll be killed. Cersei will be killed. The person he loves will be killed. And their children will be killed.
Yeah.
And there's precedent to think this based on what happened to the Targaryen children, what Robert wants to do to Daenerys. Even Ned hides a possible Targaryen child from Robert because he's afraid that Robert will basically commit child murder.
Yeah.
So Jaime has good reason to worry that this might be the outcome, right? The death of his family basically might be the outcome from Bran seeing this and telling the wrong person. And he basically has to make this kind of terrible pragmatic decision that George R. R. Martin is always putting his characters in, where, you know, you choose between two terrible options. And I think a lot of the judgment for Jamie in that situation comes from his presentation of it. That if Ned Stark is put in this position or Jon Snow is put in this position, there's a lot of like self-reflection about it. There's a lot of hemming and hawing and, oh my God, I can't do this. I don't want to have to make this decision. This decision is too hard. And Jaime kind of acts rashly and impatiently and just makes a decision he thinks he has to make in the moment. And it comes off as being very cavalier and callous.
Yeah, there's no kind of discussion, there's no debate, there doesn't seem to be any time during that very quick scene where he has thought about it and reviewed his decision or whatever. It reads like he's just made a snap decision and he's just doing it. And that's why it comes across as cavalier as well. The quip and the quickness is what makes that whole scene just seem like he didn't even think twice about killing a child.
Right. And when, you know, Jon Snow, this is not exactly analogous, but this is a similar situation where Jon Snow has to kill one of the Night's Watch brothers, Khorne Halfhand, in order to appear like he is defecting to the side of the wildlings. Now, this is different because Khorne Halfhand asked him to do it. He basically consents to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you see a lot of, you're in Jon's head for that, and you see how much he kind of struggles with this idea of, can I really do this? And then Khorne Halfhand even has to kind of push him to it by attacking him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when other characters...
That's the context. That's what you're comparing it to. Him making a decision to kill someone versus Jaime making a decision to kill someone. But the problem is, obviously, you're not in Jaime's head and you're not seeing all of his thinking or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's observed by Cersei, isn't it? It's Cersei's chapter.
And I think there's evidence that Jaime doesn't like this decision. I mean, when he says the things I do for love, he says it with loathing. And it's not clear, like, what is he loathing? What does he hate? Does he hate that he has to do this? Does he hate Cersei for making him do this, quote-unquote, making him do this?
So the presentation in the TV show might be down to Nikolai, because he kind of says it in an exasperated way rather than a loathing way, and actually he could have delivered it with much more kind of anger and stuff, but he says it in a very cavalier sort of, like, yeah, just kind of almost, he sounds almost bored when he says it.
I think he looks away, too. He turns away.
Yeah, he looks away. He doesn't look at the kid.
It's an afterthought.
He does it with one hand. It feels very, you know, brushy offy,
right.
Which I don't think is how it was presented in the book.
And as Jaime does this thing, maybe people will think that I am reading too much into this in order to
justify.
But Jaime does this thing where he lies to himself about his own motivations and about his feelings, and I think a lot of the characters in the book do it. And if you're looking for it, you can pick it up. And I think it's a testament to how good of a writer George R. Martin is. I know you don't like some of his writing, but
most.
I think he's an amazing writer, the way that he can pull off some of this stuff with characters. But I think Jaime, as you read his chapters, he begins to express regret for this.
Yeah.
And when he first starts expressing regret, he does this in a very like Jaime way, where he doesn't really want to regret his decision. So he kind of makes it like, well, this was a bad decision because of all the problems it caused, right? This basically sets off all of the events that happen in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, the fallout makes this a bad decision.
Right.
If only this hadn't all gone tits up following that one decision that I made. It's a very kind of retroactive, like, darn it, if I'd known it was going to go this way, I never would have done it.
It comes off as very selfish, like, this has become a pain in the ass for me.
Yeah, this is causing me problems. Like, now my brother's captive, like, fuck's sake.
Right.
Yeah.
And Cersei berates him for it, like, how could you do that? And, you know, she criticizes him for, like, why didn't you ever think? He was only 7. Even if he understood what he said, we should have been able to frighten him into silence, right? And Jaime kind of says, like, well, I didn't think you'd want. And then she cuts him off and says, you never think.
Classic Cersei tactic, by the way. Just threaten someone until they're terrified and they never do anything ever again.
And blaming Jaime for something that she clearly is on board with, I think.
Of course.
But she likes to outsource the blame for things. So anyway, he begin when you first see him regretting the decision, he regrets it in a very kind of selfish, personal way.
Yeah.
And then as it goes on, so this happens to Jaime, I think, with a couple different things, where he starts to feel something and he kind of addresses that he feels it, but he drapes it in the presentation that he always gives to the outside world of being selfish and amoral. And then as time goes on, it morphs into what I think it really is, which is, you know, the actual feeling of regret about how could I do that. And so, you know, toward the... I think it must be in A Dance with Dragons, but it might be in toward the end of Feast for Crows, where he thinks about all the terrible things that he's done because of Cersei and how he regrets them. And that line, the things I do for love, repeats in his head multiple times. There's one where he thinks about Cersei wanting to kill Arya for hurting Joffrey when they're fighting at, like, when they're in the King's entourage and they're going back to King's Landing, and Joffrey gets like cut on the eye or something by Arya, and Cersei wants her to be punished for it. And he thinks about how she's kind of so cavalierly wants to hurt children, and then he repeats that line in himself, in his head, the things I do for love. And then there's another moment where he tells Cersei, once he's back at King's Landing and he's gone through all these things, including his hand being cut off, that he's not ashamed of loving her. He's only ashamed of the things he did to hide it. And he kind of mutters to himself like that boy at Winterfell and trails off. So as it goes on, you see that there is like some legitimate regret over this decision, yeah. Right? But anyway, so there's another point I think that's worth bringing up at some point about Cersei or about Jaime kind of lying to himself until he admits what his true feelings are. But we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. So what's number three here? Dating Cersei?
Yeah, which dating of all his crimes, it's the least criminal, really, the least immoral. I mean, you know, whatever, incest is one thing, but like, it's not hurting anyone.
Right. And
right. I mean, I kind of can't think about it in comparable terms, like whatever two consenting adults want to do, it's fine. Like, you know, get on with it. But like the problem with Cersei is the amount of control that he lets her have over him and the fact that their whole relationship is extremely dysfunctional. And he ends up doing things for her that he shouldn't do, and she for him. And they have horrible consent issues that we won't get into because right. It's not really relevant. But like there's definitely a very dangerous element of their relationship, and that's the problem, you know.
Right. Well, there's, you know, there, how it's seen, it's seen by Westeros, even though this is a crazy double standard because they're okay with the Targaryens doing it,
yeah,
but incest is seen as like this gross, hideous crime. Yeah. And his children being the false heirs is also seen as, you know, a great crime. Yeah,
it's because it's incest with the queen, which is corrupted the lineage or whatever. That's
right.
That's a big problem in by Westeros standards, and you know, whatever.
I think in our reality, you know, we might have problems with incest, but it is essentially two adults consenting to something in one way, yeah, or another. Now the TV show presents their relationship a little bit differently because it shows a scene where Jaime rapes Cersei.
Yeah.
In the Sept after Joffrey dies.
Which the disgusting producers tried to say wasn't a rape scene, by right. the way.
So not only do they kind of do some character assassination and have Jaime rape Cersei, but then they didn't even realize that that was what they filmed. It's ridiculous.
Anyway.
But, I mean, in the books, a similar thing happens, but it is much more complex. And it doesn't mean it wasn't rape, but it doesn't mean it was consensual, but it is much more nuanced in how it's presented, and it kind of reveals the extent that their relationship is unhealthy and dysfunctional, and that part of the thing that they do, even though kind of big picture they kind of consent to being with each other, that they relate to each other often by doing things that are non-consensual with the other person. So They have a messed up relationship. They have an extremely unhealthy, dysfunctional relationship where, you know, there are plenty of consent issues. But the TV show basically presented that as like attacker rape, in a very clear cut, lack of complexity way that ruins Jaime in many ways. They also present Jaime as murdering his cousin when he's captured by the Starks.
Stone him in the head.
Right, they crush his face with a stone.
Not even I'm sorry, and stabbing him, like brutally murdering him.
To create a distraction, basically, come to get on. The guards in. And it's
dumb.
Crazy, right?
Yeah, super dumb.
So, I think the worst part of Cersei is the toxicity of that relationship, not necessarily some kind of, like, crime against the king or the land or Westeros social mores.
Yeah.
Okay, so number four is the big one. This is the thing that makes Jaime the best. And I think this is the
best.
This is the most kind of clean cut heroic act that he does that is completely misinterpreted by everybody else.
Yeah.
So everyone else sees Jaime is helping his father sack King's Landing and cutting the king's throat and sitting on the throne like an arrogant bastard. When in reality, his entire kind of tenure as a king's guard and tenure as watching Aerys is kind of one long confrontation with his idea about being a knight and being heroic with the reality of serving a horrible, horrible person in power.
So this is the interesting thing about talking about Jaime and heroism, because Jaime wants to be a classic hero, right? This is his goal.
Yeah, when he's young, he looks up to knights like Sir Arthur Dayne and who have kind of, you know, whether or not we don't know what the real character of Arthur Dayne's heart
but the
is.
Myth but and yes, the legend.
The story about him is this kind of fairy tale knight who protects the innocent and fights the good fight. In the same way that, like, that's kind of what Sansa thinks about knights, and that's why she wants to be involved in, you know, in the court and
jousting and shit.
Right. The noble myth about what a knight is. Jaime wanted that. Jaime, as a little kid, that's what he wanted to grow up and be. And when he becomes a Kingsguard, he becomes the youngest Kingsguard ever in the history of Westeros, and he kind of thinks that that is what's happening to him. And in reality, he has that kind of ideal broken down piece by piece. So the first thing that happens is he realizes his being appointed to the Kingsguard was really a kind of vicious political move by Aerys the king to deprive Tywin of his heir.
Yeah.
So once you become a member of the Kingsguard, you serve
proper heir.
Right. Once you become a member of the Kingsguard, you serve for life, you take no lands, you take no wife, blah blah blah, all the standard stuff. Which means
it's like the Night's Watch, but
it is like the Night's Watch. And it's the white versus the black. So there's parallels between the Night's Watch and the Kingsguard. So Aerys did this to punish Tywin Lannister. He took away the heir that Tywin wants to succeed him, which is Jaime.
Yeah.
And he makes it so Jaime can never inherit Casterly Rock, and he can't ever hold any other positions of power, and he forces Tyrion to become the heir of Casterly Rock, which is an even bigger slap in the face to Tywin, because Tywin hates Tyrion, and now this disfigured dwarf who kind of is publicly drunk and engages in all kinds of, like, you know, unbecoming, quote-unquote, lewd behavior, now he is going to inherit Casterly Rock, and what a gigantic embarrassment that is going to be to the family, which is the exact thing that Tywin hates. So it's even used once the rebellion starts and the war is happening between Robert and Ned and Aerys. Many of the other Kingsguard go out to fight in the field, and Tywin never declares. So Tywin and the Lannisters always kind of stay neutral, and they don't side with the rebels, and they don't side with Aerys. And one of the reasons why is because Aerys intentionally keeps Jaime close to him to hold him hostage over Tywin.
Yeah.
So even, you know, throughout this entire time being Kingsguard, he's used as a pawn against his father by the king.
It's a similar thing where we talk about how Cersei's used as a pawn, but so's Jaime. And it's interesting that she kind of resents Jaime because she sees in Jaime what she wants, which is the chance to have adventure and stuff, and she thinks that she's been demoted to being just, you know, married off or whatever. But, like, the exact same thing happens with Jaime. He's just being used as a political chess piece between these two kind of powerful men as well, and it's quite an interesting parallel. But I think what's really sad about Jaime becoming a member of the Kingsguard and, like, seeing behind the curtain, to steal a phrase from Oz, is that it's like the devastation of wish fulfillment. Like, if you ever get what you want and then it doesn't live up to everything that you thought it would be. And in this case, it's so extreme because, you know, Aerys is a bad king and he has to watch him do loads of bad stuff. And so then it culminates in this moment that you're about to discuss.
Well, we should actually talk about the Cersei thing too, because...
Go for it.
One of the other reasons, I mean, he does want to be a knight and stuff, but one of the reasons why he accepts the idea of asking to be on the Kingsguard, because I think they petition Aerys for it, is because he thinks he'll be close to Cersei. It's Cersei's idea. She's at court. She convinces Jaime, if you want to be near me, like, let's get you on the Kingsguard, and then you'll always be at court too. And then as soon as he's accepted, and Tywin realizes that Aerys did it only to kind of as an insult to him, he brings Cersei back from court. So he also loses the other kind of benefit that he was going to be from being on the King's Guard, which was to be next to his sister who he loved. And your point about
it's
Cersei.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Cersei is not a good strategist. Your point about Cersei and Jaime being kind of mirrors of each other it's one of the reasons why Cersei probably has the best understanding of the sexism in Westeros and the way this kind of patriarchal society operates, because her and Jaime, she sees them as being the same person. She even says it, you know, we're one person in two different bodies, and they grew up together. And so she sees Jaime being groomed for lordship and to be a knight and to be a heroic and to own lands and to be a leader. And while he's being groomed for that, she sees him herself being groomed to be traded off from her father to some other lord for, you know, political maneuvering as basically a piece of property.
Yeah.
And that's true. But if the other side of it is what you mentioned, that even Jaime is basically victim to this.
Yeah, they all are.
Right. This system. So while Jaime's Kingsguard, he sees Aerys do terrible, terrible things, and he is confronted a couple of different times with the idea of being a knight and being noble versus protecting Aerys. So one of them is when Aerys murders Brandon and Rickard Stark, which is Ned Stark's brother and his father, and he murders them in a horrible way where he cooks Ned Stark's father alive in his suit of armor while his brother watches, and his brother can free him if he can reach the sword, but there is a noose around his neck, so in trying to reach the sword he slowly strangles himself to death as his father burns alive.
And here we have, you know, George R. R. Martin's classic torture porn. Gross. Yeah. Super
right.
Gross.
Horrible thing. And Jaime has to stand there and watch it, and he does this thing where he calls it going away inside, where he's confronted with like this fact that this is a terrible thing that, and I'm a party to it. And I think he even mentions it to someone at the, you know, in the moment where it's happening, Sir Gerald Hightower or something. And Gerald, who's another member of the Kingsguard, and Gerald Hightower tells him, you know, you swore a vow to guard the king, not to judge him. And so he kind of has to cope with this cognitive dissonance between what it means to be a knight and what it means to protect the king.
Because in all knight stories, the king is the goody, and you're supposed to, you know, be heroic and support the king because the king is the symbol of good. And in this case, obviously, the reality of this world is that the king is corrupt and gross.
Right. And there's another moment where the king rapes his own wife, and he does it in a horrible, vicious way. And Jaime has to stand guard outside of the room while it's happening. And it's this another moment where he forces himself to go away inside. And I think this is also another moment where he says something to another member of the Kingsguard, like, you know, we swore a vow to protect her too. And the other member of the Kingsguard says, yeah, but not from him. So he's continually faced with this, like, you have to be bad to fulfill your vow, basically. You have to be evil. You have to allow terrible, evil things to happen to innocents because you're a knight, which is...
And, I mean, breaking your oath and breaking your vow is not an honorable thing to do, right? If you're a classic knight and that's what you're trying to be and you're trying to live up to this stereotype of heroism, the worst thing that you can do is break an oath. And I compare it to Alexander Dumas in The Three Musketeers and the follow-on from those, where, you know, Louis is an evil king and then D'Artagnan refuses to not serve him even though he's corrupt, and it's like an oath is an oath because it can't be removed. Direct quote from Gabriel Byrne portraying him in The Man in the Iron Mask starring Leonardo DiCaprio, not because I'm super super clever and know stuff about books, but it's a similar kind of concept where it's like, well, if you're a knight and you've sworn an oath to a king, is it dishonorable to break your oath if the king is a baddie? And the whole point is that you're not supposed to ever break an oath. That's the point of an oath.
That's not, that's the that's the way that an honorable person behaves.
Hashtag honorable thing to do.
So this culminates in the big moment where Jaime kills Aerys. And when you finally realize the reason why, it's it's because Jamie realizes that Eris has been hiding wildfire, it's like napalm, the super destructive substance, all over King's Landing, the capital, and that if Tywin, well, not if Tywin, he's thinking about if the rebels get in, then he's going to torch the whole city and kill 500,000 people. And Jamie, I don't think Jamie wants him to open the gates and let his father in, but Master Pycelle convinces Aerys to open the gates, let Tywin in. Tywin starts sacking and destroying the city, and Jamie's actually trying to defend the city, defend the Red Keep, and he sends a message to Aerys saying, like, please, you know, make peace with the invaders. Like, we're not going to win this. It doesn't matter. But you can save a lot of these people that are dying in this horrible sack of King's Landing by giving up, right? By surrendering. And Aerys sends back to him, you know, a message saying, like, bring me your father's head, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to hear it. Go kill your father. And then when he sends him this letter, Jaime realizes that Aerys is going to execute his plan with the pyromancers and burn King's Landing to the ground and kill everyone. So Jaime goes back to the Red Keep and he kills the pyromancer, and then he finds Aerys and he slits Aerys' throat before he can give the order to anybody else to burn the city down.
So he does it to save the city.
He does it to save, yeah, 500,000 people. And
then the city gets ransacked anyway.
Right. And then his father destroys the city anyway, and Jaime inherits some of the blame for that.
Because Tywin's a piece of shit.
And then over the next few days, he also hunts down and kills the rest of the pyromancers that know where the location of the wildfire is, just to make sure that nobody can ever set off this bomb, basically.
Yeah.
And that's like the greatest moment of dishonor, because he swore a vow to protect Aerys and he ends up killing him. And Ned Stark hates him for this. This is like, you're in Ned's head for the first book, and this is like one of the major reasons why he doesn't trust the Lannisters and why he doesn't like Jaime, is because he found Jaime sitting on the throne and he had killed the king, and he petitions Ned to send Jaime to the Night's Watch and to, you know, strip him of his Kingsguard position and stuff. And even Robert is like, this doesn't make sense. Somebody had to kill Aerys, right? We were rebelling against him. But Ned is like, well, we didn't swear the oath to protect him, even though they swore fealty.
Yeah, it's an interesting double standard from him, isn't it?
Right. But it reflects, I think, what George is trying to criticize with a lot of Westeros, but particularly with Jaime, the idea that of what is honorable and good that's accepted at large in society and what is actually
Yeah,
good.
Because Ned follows all the rules and gets himself killed as a result of that, right? He follows them, like, to the letter, pretty much, where he's, like, tries to do everything that is hashtag honorable.
Right.
You know, and it ends up costing him, because the reality of the situation is you can't act like that. You can't be this kind of romantic with a capital R hero in a world that doesn't respect that and respond to that kind of
And
that kind of character.
Ned's most heroic act, or what I think is Ned's most heroic act, is of course when he betrays his own honor.
Yeah, and saves John.
And to save John, right? He lies. Yeah. I mean, this is according to this fan theory, which I'm sure everybody who has read
it's
the book
knows.
It's
a pretty famous fan theory, yeah. I'm pretty sure it's also true.
that John is not really his son. It's his sister's son with Rhaegar Targaryen. But he knows that if Robert, once he becomes king, will want to kill any Targaryen heirs because they challenge his claim to the throne. So he, you know, breaks his honor and claims that he slept with another woman and cheated on his wife, and that John is actually his son. And I think that further fits in the idea of the commentary about what is right and good, and what Westeros sees as being right and good are two very different things.
It's an interesting parallel between the two acts, actually, because in both situations the men are doing something that is good, but it's projecting them as bad, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, Ned feels bad about it, where Ned, just like a lot of the Starks, including Jon Snow, have this kind of self-pitying, woe is me, I have to make hard decisions, and it's
Jon
so...
Jon does have to make hard decisions.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown. Leadership is so hard. And Jaime kind of owns the, which is, I think, another reason why people dislike Jamie so much, is he kind of owns that, like, if you're going to see me this way, then I'll be this way, right? If you think I'm a monster and I don't care and I'm callous, then, like, whatever. I don't owe you anything. I'm not going to try to explain myself to you.
Which is a very attractive quality that not just Jamie, but all the Lannisters have, actually, where they don't care what people think about them at all. And it's, like, quite an interesting, even Tyrion to an extent.
Tywin may, but he would never admit that.
He doesn't act that way, though, does he? Well, yeah, I mean, Tywin's just concerned about embarrassment. But, like, I think that it's quite interesting because it's, like, perceived as arrogance and whatever. And, like, yeah, you could read it that way, or you could just read it that it's like, actually, do you know what, I'm confident in my decisions and your opinion of me doesn't change who I am. And I think Jamie probably takes a lot of solace in the fact that it doesn't matter what people think that he thinks he did the right thing. And,
well,
like,
I don't know if he does. He seems to wonder at times when you're in his head about how amoral he really is. And I think that there's an element of
That's good. We all think that, and we all should think that. We should always question, are we actually being a good person? I think, again, it's another kind of attractive quality in him, you know?
I think it is, but I also think I think this happens with anybody. I think, again, this is, you know, a testament to the quality of the characters, that people take on the stories that everyone else imposes on them, right? If society or your peers or whoever have this story about who you are and what kind of person you are, that you begin to take it on, whether or not that's really who you are deep down in your soul, being known for this thing starts to seep into your real personality.
It's an interesting kind of, it brings up this whole conversation that we have about reputation and kind of the way you present and whether or not, how you present and your reputation actually feeds into whether or not you can actually be honourable. I think part of the struggle with Jamie being perceived as a heroic character is his lack of concern for what people think about him. That plays totally against the fact that all the other hashtag moral, hashtag honourable characters present in that way. Do you know what I mean? They kind of are like, no, I am an honourable character, and they kind of reiterate their honour in various different ways and, like, wear it. And so again,
they go through the motions even if they don't feel it.
Yeah, totally. And so there are certain characters that present as honorable/moral, whatever, but arguably are not. And so it's just, I don't know, it kind of plays with the whole idea of perception. And I think, again, it's part of the problem that we have with Ned. He's so worried about doing the right thing and presenting in this way that he ends up getting his whole family killed.
Right. And what he does, I mean, when we talked about this before, I mentioned that he does. I think when push comes to shove, Ned forsakes honor in favor of doing what he thinks will protect people. Like, he makes the deal to admit that he conspired against Joffrey and that Joffrey's the rightful king, even though that's a lie. And, oh my God, it hurts him so much to ever tell a lie.
It's too little too late, though, isn't it, with Ned? That's the problem. Right, it's just like, you can't just suddenly be, you know, it doesn't play out for him because it's not. I can't think how to word it, so maybe you should word it how I mean it.
He doesn't do any of the, like, pragmatic plotting or planning.
No, none.
He just kind
and
of
more
does
for
the, like,
him for I, that. You know?
I'm going to be bullheaded and shove power through this just by sheer force of honor, and that will protect me. And of course, that gets his head chopped off and his whole family destroyed.
Yeah. So in that way, I can understand Jamie's pragmatic approach, right? And it makes him much more, it makes his actions easier to forgive in light of the fact that we see a character who refuses to be pragmatic, utterly destroyed within the first, you know, seven episodes, you know, the first two thirds of the book or whatever.
And it makes sense for Jamie to be like that once his whole reputation and everything is destroyed. He's jaded. He's had this whole idea of knights that is completely wrong, right? The worst people are knights, and the worst people are the people that are in power.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's and what's that guy who gets sent up to the wall who's terrible?
Janice Slint?
Yeah, right? Ew, yeah. Gross. They're all like him. It's disgusting.
So he kind of becomes jaded and has less of a problem with the, like, how do I appear to everyone else? But it still matters to him. And I think once you get in his head, he does a lot of wondering. Like, when Joffrey dies, he says that he feels nothing, and he feels like, am I a monster because of this? Because I don't care that my own son is dead. I see Brienne crying over Robb Stark being killed, and she doesn't even know him, but I feel nothing because Joffrey is killed. And as it goes on, he gets a little bit more perspective on that. Like, you know, Joffrey wasn't really my son. I had nothing to do with him, but it's, and he was a monster, obviously.
Yeah.
But Jaime still struggles with the idea of like, have I become basically what everybody thinks I am? Am I the monster everybody claims inside? And I think, so if we talk about the future, the present day events that happen in the show and the books, I think that's what really starts to change about him. And that's the main part of his redemptive arc, is his relationship with Brienne, where he basically starts to see someone who does do the right thing no matter what, and kind of does still have honor when she does it, and cares about kind of being, she's not jaded yet. And he part, I mean, his relationship with her also helps her, I think, as you said before.
Yeah. It makes her a bit more of a realist in the way that, like, you know, when Renly gets murdered, she's like, I'm going to fight everyone. And Caitlin's like, you need to get out of here. Everyone's going to think that you did this. I'm remembering that, right?
Yeah. Like, and she just, she's kind of perplexed by the idea that people would, like, not take her at her word, and would mistrust her, or that people would say one thing to her, but do something else because, like, that's not honorable.
Yeah, absolutely. And he definitely helps her to understand that, I think. Throughout that, their relationship is amazing. It's one of my favorite things in the whole of the series.
And he just by existing, I think he presents the idea to her that somebody who you think has shit for honor and is a bad person, you get to know them and you find out that they're actually good, and that this is just a story about them.
Yeah, like, people are complex, right? No one is entirely good. No one is entirely bad. To quote Sirius Black from Harry Potter, you know, we have both light and dark inside of us, right? And it's just the bit that you choose to act on that's important. That's paraphrasing, but he is smart and also a bay for life. But, like, you know, it's that idea about actually... I was going to call her Gwendolyn. That's not her name. Sorry, Brienne starts to see this complexity in Jaime, and then, you know, stops putting on a front, because Brienne's another one that puts on a bit of a front. You know, she physically wears armor. She's trying to present in a certain way, and she stops doing that so much. And it's interesting to see that development as well. But it's the losing of his hand, I think, that marks the real turning point, and probably is why a lot of people will say Jaime becomes good. I am interested in this theory that you have, that he was always good. It's just, it gets kind of almost intensified by this act. But yeah, I think losing of his hand, which is one of the most brutal scenes I've ever seen / read. It came out of nowhere. It was amazing.
Right. And you know, I think the losing the hand thing is kind of makes him reassess what his identity is, because he says, like, that hand was me. I
was that hand. Yeah.
Right.
It's a horrible line. I feel really sorry for him in that moment.
And so he has to kind of, the things that he still takes pride in, like his swordsmanship and his skill and being, you know, that represents kind of like being a whole man and being a whole person who's dangerous and can take care of himself and can protect the people that he cares about, that goes away, and he kind of has to figure out what his identity is with once all of that is stripped away.
Yeah.
And I think that's when he gets back to the idea that, like, I'm still going to try to be, it's not like I am turning good now, but I'm going to go back to this idea that I had when I was a kid, and I wanted to be like Arthur Dayne. And he thinks, there's a line that I love from Jaime, where he's looking at the White Book, which is the book of all the other Kingsguard, and he's looking at how all of them and how they died and that they're gone now. And he's thinking about himself as a boy, admiring all these men, previous Kingsguard members. And he thinks, you know, that boy that I was, when did he die? Was it when I donned the white cloak? Was it when I opened Aerys's throat? The boy that wanted to be Sir Arthur Dayne, but someplace along the way, he'd become the Smiling Knight instead. And the Smiling Knight, is, if you don't remember, is kind of the Gregor Clegane of Jaime's youth.
Yeah. Super baddie. Bloodthirsty.
Right. But chivalrous. That's why they call him a knight. He's kind of a chivalrous, psychotic knight. And
we know that chivalry is so important, she said disdainfully. It's a great moment for his character development, obviously. And it's just like an example of, like, how sometimes in life, something happens to you and you are irredeemably, like you're changed by it. Nothing will ever right. be the same again. And that's what happens to Jamie. He has this massive part of his identity erased in a split second. And it's how he copes with that is very, very interesting.
And it's also how other people react to it, because totally. Those two relationships we talked about earlier, Cersei and Tywin, when he goes back and sees them, him not having this hand is like, he sees how they are using him and they only want him for certain purposes. And him being unwilling to do that, right? His Jamie says she's a fool, or Cersei tells him she's a fool for ever loving him.
Yeah.
His father disowns him because his father says, oh, it's good that you got your hand cut off, because now we can get you off of the Kingsguard and you can go back to Casterly Rock and you can become the heir of Casterly Rock. And Jamie's like, God, every single thing that happens to me just ends up being some, like, you know, political machination to get my father what he wants, or to get Cersei what she wants. And
yeah, they're nothing if not resourceful.
Right. And he tells him, like, no, I'm not, you know, I'm on the Kingsguard now and I'm going to see it through. And like, this is what I'm going to do. And he tries to regain like that, basically who he was as a boy, who he was all along inside, right? This kid who was trying to do the right thing, but that kept being manipulated at every step of the way by people in power and by the bad toxic relationships in his life. He kind of says, I've had enough of all of that. I've had enough of the vows. I've had enough of, you know, you people trying to manipulate me. I'm going to kind of go back to this identity that I have inside and try to do the right thing no matter what happens. And a lot of that is also seeing what the Kingsguard has become because of Cersei, where it's like, you know, she's just given people political favors, basically appointed them to the Kingsguard, and they're all like sleazy sellswords who have no honor, quote unquote honor. And he sees what the Lannister troops have done as he's traveling through the Riverlands. This doesn't happen in the TV show because he goes on his little buddy adventure with Bronn. But in the books, he goes to the Riverlands, which have just been devastated by the war, and he sees the terrible things that the Lannisters have done, and he even hangs Lannister men for their crimes against, you know, innocent people. And so he turns it around, but like I've said in the beginning, I think he doesn't turn it around in a way where he was evil before and is good now. He turns it in a way where he's reasserting this identity that has been inside of him the entire time.
So do you think the problem with Jamie and why people perceive him in a certain way is because he's not this classic hero? But you use this phrase quite a lot whenever we're discussing heroism as a trope, the pragmatic hero, in contrast to the romantic hero or the stereotypical hero or whatever. And so it's not even necessarily that he does heroic stuff and has lots of hashtag honor in that traditional sense of it. It's that he is a good person. He's just operating within a context that doesn't enable him to only do good deeds.
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of he does good things and is misunderstood about them.
Yeah. So it's perception.
Right, there's an element of perception. And then there's an element of he's within a system where he ends up having to participate in evil and having to choose it. Even if he regrets it later, even if it's a bad act, he commits bad acts.
When I think about heroes in Game of Thrones, I think the one that always springs to mind for me isn't my baby boy, Jon Snow, although I love him to death. I think probably if I had to pick the hero in Game of Thrones, I would say it was Stannis Seaworthy. Now, if I think about him in light of Jaime, what he lacks is the drive that Jaime has. Right? He's kind of responsive and like loyal, and he's a good person. He doesn't do anything bad, but he's not proactive enough to be a hero.
He has a touch of the Neddins
where
he thinks, you know, it's honorable to follow what my king says and to take commands.
But he challenges Stannis in a way that Ned never challenges Robert.
And he goes against Stannis' wishes when he thinks that's what's right. Like,
he doesn't want
to let the Melisandre kill one of Robert's bastards.
Right.
So he sets him free. And Stannis punishes him for it. So,
and he takes the punishment.
He takes it, but
which is a really interesting and weird kind
That's
of,
a touch of the Neddins. That's being Ned Stark, is thinking that, like, you know, okay, I broke my vow in this instance because I thought it was the right thing to do, but I still deserve to be punished for breaking my vow.
But what I like about Sir Davos is that he is consistent, and he seems, people suggest that he's kind of one-dimensional, but I don't think he is. I think he's got a lot of complexity, and I think the guy that, I can't remember his name, that portrays him in TV show is amazing. And like, he just has this kind of, what I like about him is that he's consistent and he follows this, he does what he thinks is right in all instances, and then he kind of accepts repercussions from that, you know what I mean? And that is very right. satisfying, whereas I feel like Jamie wants to get away with stuff.
I think Jamie operates almost like a character from our world who would be placed in this system of morals and rules and cultural norms, and he's like, I don't give a fuck about this.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I should, you know, this, I'm gonna do what I think is best, and I don't care what you think. All right, so about the heroism stuff, I think that there's the misunderstanding thing, which Jamie, when you read his chapters, he's very frustrated with, like, when he's trying to negotiate in the Riverlands for a peaceful, ending of the siege that's happening to the Tully's castle. And part of it is because he swore to Catelyn Stark that he would never take up arms against her family. And so he wants to find a way where he can not break his vow and still end the siege. Which is interesting, because that's not what you would expect Jamie to do.
No.
But this might be another example where he starts out lying to himself about why he feels certain ways, and then eventually kind of admits it. So when we have to back up for this part, but when Catelyn releases him when he's imprisoned by the Starks and the Tullys, and Catelyn releases him, she makes him swear a vow that he will return Sansa and Arya.
Yeah.
And as he is traveling with Brienne, I think it's before he even has his hand cut off, he thinks about, I'm going to honor my vow, even though, you know, I was drunk and she had me held at knife point, and I don't know how legitimate it is that I made this agreement, but I'm going to honor it. And he kind of laughs that to himself, that the only reason he's going to honor it is kind of to troll everyone who thinks he has shit for honor. Just to see their faces when the Kingslayer actually follows through on something. That's why he's going to honor it. Which to me reads very plainly is he's lying to him. He wants to honor it because he cares about doing the right thing, but he has to present it with this veneer of like, well, I'm cocky, I don't care, I'm only doing it just to fuck with people even more. And then as time goes on, he actually undermines his sister and Tywin and gives Brienne a Valyrian sword called Oathkeeper and tells her, you know, go and find Sansa Stark and bring her back to Winterfell. And there's no, I'm only doing this to troll people, I'm only doing this to mess with people. He has come around to the real motivation for it, which is that he wants to do it, that Sansa deserves to go home, and that he's trying to be a noble person.
And also, I mean, the fact that he asked Brienne to do it, who's someone that he's come to care about, and that there's real risk involved. He's not going to like risk his friend's life for a troll, right?
Right, exactly. And you know, he names the sword Oathkeeper, which is like significant.
It's nice as well, because like Brienne gets so overwhelmed by it. It's such a lovely moment.
She thinks he has some other plot to bring Sansa back or something. And he gets pissed because, again, it's like this other misunderstanding. And then she apologizes and she's like, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have judged you. And this happens when they both get back to King's Landing. And Sir Loras wants to kill her because he thinks that she killed Renly.
Yeah.
And he orders that Brienne be taken by the city watch and be put into a tower cell and kept. And Brienne looks at him when he does this like, how can you have me imprisoned after everything that we've been through? After, you know, rescuing me, which, by the way, an extremely heroic moment when he goes back to rescue Brienne from the bear pit.
Yep, standout performance from Bart the Bear.
With no weapon, not even an arm. He does it because he thinks that the men that are taking him back to King's Landing won't let him die. And that they'll stop the bear, and he, you know, puts her behind him and has the bear threaten him so that they'll shoot it with arrows. But super heroic that he just does because he cares about her.
Yeah, he's wonderful in that moment. It's and you know, he lies to himself a little bit again, like when he presents, right? When he talks to her about it.
Yeah, he lies to her about it. And he always is like thinking to himself, like, ugh, you know, this trip would have been better if I hadn't rescued her. And yeah. I rescued the most boring person to have on a journey with me. But yeah, when he orders her taken to the tower cell, Brienne looks at him like he's betrayed her. And how can you have me imprisoned as soon as I get here? And he thinks to himself, like, you ought to be blowing me kisses, wench, which he always calls her in his head. But he's like, why must they misunderstand every bloody thing he did? Yeah. Eris, it always comes back to Eris. And so he's kind of haunted by that misunderstanding that so even when he does things that are, I mean, that's, again, super pragmatic move, right? Have Brienne arrested and put in a tower cell for her own protection.
Yeah. But then why doesn't he tell her that's what he's doing?
Because it's just, it happens really quick and they take her away. And he has the attitude. He has the attitude of like, why do I have to explain myself to everyone all the time?
See, this is the thing that I do struggle with him. I'm just like, well, if it upsets you so much that people think this about you, why don't you tell them? And it's, I remember someone challenges him about it. Like, why didn't you tell Ned? And he's like, I can't remember what he says. You probably will know.
It's the scene in the baths in Harrenhal, which is the best, probably my favorite scene in the TV show. Also one of my favorite scenes in the book, where he is all messed up from having his surgery on his hand, and he's in the hot bathhouse, and he's kind of like half passing out, and Cersei keeps calling him Kingslayer. And then he tells her the story about what actually happened with Aerys, that Aerys was going to destroy the entire city, and that he did it to stop him. And Brienne is like, well, why doesn't anybody know this? And he's like, Ned Stark didn't want to hear this, right? Ned Stark judged me the second he saw me, and he had his preconceptions about me. And so he has this, like, I'm too good to explain myself to people kind of thing.
Which isn't a heroic quality, let's be real. But, you know, it's a real quality. It's something that we all have, right? Like, where it's like, you know, you get sick of it. You get sick of trying to explain your actions to people that seem to want to see the worst in you. I mean, I think, like, I'm with him on that front because I hate Ned. So, like, whatever, Ned's an idiot. I wouldn't explain myself to him either. But I do think that he's got massive issues with trust. He's got, like, that Lannister arrogance, and all of these things just make his life so much harder for him. That's what it's frustrating as a fan to watch him just make his life more difficult for himself. But as with all pragmatic heroes, they sort of tend to do that. Like, I think about him in contrast to another one of your favorites, Wesley, in Angel. And it's similar. It's like, why don't you just say something so that people know why you're doing all this weird stuff rather than them thinking the worst of you? And part of me is like, well, actually, why did they think the worst of him? Surely he would have legitimate reasons and blah, blah, blah.
But well, then, it's always frustrating in shows where, like, simple things could be resolved if people had a conversation and they just don't have that conversation. But sometimes there's legitimate reasons for it. And, all right, so should we
I'm rambling
head toward
off,
wrapping
sorry.
This up?
Yeah.
I think, you were talking about kind of heroism in general and how Jaime fits into that. Again, I want to reiterate, he's not my personal favorite white boy. He's not my Draco in leather pants. Like, there's a lot of problems with Jaime. He has arrogance and personality defects. He
tried to kill a kid.
He's misogynistic in certain ways. He has something that a lot of the nobles have in the books, where he kind of regards normal people's lives as being less valuable than commoners' lives are less valuable than nobles' lives.
Rampant classism.
Yes, classism, exactly. So, you know, he has problems and he has negative qualities, but he is misunderstood in many ways. And he is, I don't want to say forced, but he is put in situations and puts himself in situations where he has to make decisions that are immoral, basically. And he has to live with them. And that makes him much more kind of complicated hero than your Tolkien-esque hero, or, you know, your Superman, your romantic heroes, which we want to do an episode on at some point, romantic versus pragmatic heroes. But this is kind of a good example of a hero that isn't all squeaky clean, purity, noble, but that is instead, I think, fundamentally trying to do the right thing and just being pulled in a lot of different directions and being misunderstood and making bad choices and having to live with the consequences of those and being warped by that. So, yeah. And then maybe why this is important to me. I think Jaime is probably my favorite character.
That's interesting.
And I think it's because I...
In, like, media? Like, in all media?
No, in the this
in
universe.
Game of in Thrones, Song of Ice. Yeah.
Right. But I do like him. I mean, he is very...
He's up there.
He's up there, yeah. And I think it's because I value this representation of heroes. The Superman-esque hero is... It's interesting, and I think that there's obviously value in showing all different kinds of heroes and all different kinds of people being heroes and being heroes in different ways. But particularly this kind of hero who is heroic by his own standards or by, you know, quote-unquote real standards versus right. the mores of society and the norms of society's standards. And a character who pays a price for doing that. Right, is that's similar to Wesley in Angel, that
there's cost, right?
Right, there is a cost to being this kind of hero who lives in the real world and makes hard decisions and sometimes makes the wrong decisions and does bad things, and that part of being that kind of like pragmatic hero is
being a little fallible,
bearing the burden of possibly being a bad person, of flirting with immorality or amorality. In service to what you think is actually right or good.
The greater good.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why I like him. And I just, the presentation of him in the books, I love. It's amazing. It also reminds me of Omar a little bit. Omar Little from The Wire, who also, when you first see him, is kind of presented as being this hardened evil criminal. Gangbanger. Mm-hmm. Right. Man's got to have a cone.
Yeah. And this is Jamie's, right? this whole conversation is Jamie's code in extensive dialogue, I guess. But I mean, I find Jamie a very interesting character and I warm to him and I like him very, very much. But I still, having had multiple conversations with you on this topic, I am starting to buy into this like wider consideration that actually Jamie maybe was always a good guy, but was kind of trapped by circumstances. I love a victim of circumstance. It's like one of my favorite tropes. And so, you know, I can kind of get behind it. But I think what I will definitely say about Jamie is that he has a lot of heroic qualities and he's probably one of the realest characters in Game of Thrones in terms of how he responds to what's happening around him. And like, he's a proper survivor, which is a super attractive quality in someone and a heroic quality. So he definitely has a lot of classic heroic qualities about him. But I don't know whether he could ever be classified as a hero. But we'll see. What do people think, I wonder?
You don't even think a tragic hero?
It's, do you know, for me, the deal breaker is Bran. That's the deal breaker for
me.
The
Bran thing is hard to reconcile.
And I definitely understand the defense that it was his children or this child. And I can see, again, how that is a totally pragmatic thing to do. But if I compare that to my favorite hero of all time, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, she didn't do that to Dawn. You know what I mean? She would rather
She's a romantic hero.
She's a romantic hero, definitely. But
she'll find a way without breaking what she considers to be good.
You know, Bran is the thing that I can't quite...
Right. And I can't really defend that. My defense of that is just that the context for it is not
what it's not presented to us. Yeah, it's not bloodthirsty or flippant or whatever, you know, any of these other things that could be said about him. And I completely understand that partial defense, that it's how it's perceived that's a real problem. It's not, you know, it's interpreted and presented as being this malicious throwaway act that resulted in a child being, you know, disabled. But the reality of the situation is much more complex than that. But it's still, for me, I think it's the sticking point.
Right. And I qualifications. I don't want to whitewash Jamie and I don't
no,
want
I know.
I don't want him to be more likable by saying he was always good, because I also really like heroes that started out as being bad and turned it around. You know, if you're referencing the Buffy the Vampire Slayer universe, people like Angel and Spike.
Yeah.
Right, who are, I mean, they are everything that people think Jamie is, I think. It is actually Spike and Angel before they kind of turn good. They are vicious, they're bloodthirsty, they don't care about anything.
Yeah, I think I'm in the camp that is Jamie always had goodness in him, maybe, but he wasn't a good person, and then he became a good person Right. I still think I'm dipping a toe into your camp, but I'm still largely... Okay. I mean,
he is going away inside. They use that phrase multiple times. And he tells Tommen to do the same thing
King
later
of
in the books.
Yeah.
Right. Basically, like, you know, repress
you'd
the parts
to,
of you that are not okay with this.
You're a Lannister. You'd have to repress everything. Let's be real.
So, okay, that's good. We finally did the Jaime episode. It took a couple tries.
It did take a few tries. And I didn't talk about Jon Snow hardly at all. Well,
I know. I'm really impressed with that.
I'm proud of my restraint because I bloody love him.
We'll do a Jon Snow episode where I trash him the whole time and you defend him the whole time.
No one will listen to a Jon Snow episode. I'm the only person that likes him.
There's a lot of people that like Kit Harington has won more people to the Jon Snow side, I think, than Jon Snow himself ever did.
By being an absolute dreamboat.
Okay.
He is. God, he's so handsome. And at least he started, his acting's got much better.
Yeah. Have you seen him in Pompeii? Is that how you know?
Pompeii's amazing. I don't know what you're
talking
about.
Have you listened
about.
To the Flophouse
yes,
about Pompeii?
Of course.
We
I
should
love
put
it.
That in the show notes
oh,
for
Jesus.
Other people to enjoy.
So good. Pompeii's amazing. And so Spooks, and so is everything else I've seen him in that's pretty terrible.
We should thank everyone for listening to this.
Yeah, thank you.
Long
you
got, episode.
Yeah, it was good though. I think it's pretty difficult to mount a defense against, as I said, someone that's committed pretty terrible crimes. And I think you did a pretty decent job, bro.
I think people who are real deep into the books may have already been a little bit on my side about this and not think that it's as extraordinary, but definitely TV show watchers, I think you are getting
like
a terrible representation of Jaime in the TV show among many other characters.
Yeah, character sabotage.
So thanks for listening. We'd love to hear what you think. You can tweet us.
Yep.
Katie, you want to tell them how?
Oh, I'm at Kingdom Horse, all one word.
And I'm at Will Moyer, WILLMOYER. And thank you. And we want to thank Joshua Duchesne again for our music. And you can find his site in our show notes. And thanks again for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.